Ask you all to please turn off your cell phones. If you're a surgeon and you're on call, it's okay. The rest of you, turn them off. Put them on silent. No phones tonight. Because if you even think about your phone, you're going to miss something amazing. And we have a fantastic, fantastic panel conversation that you're going to be listening to, so you won't want to miss a bit of it. We also want to make sure that you do not take any flash photography in the theater. It's very distracting up here. After the event, we are going to have a reception in our gallery, so you will have plenty of opportunities to take pictures and to speak with Laverne and to ask her any questions you want. So please keep anything that might distract the program to a minimum. As I said, tonight is the kickoff of our Trans Pride celebration, and this is one of a day and a half of amazing events. I hope you all are planning to come back tomorrow, where we're going to have an entire day full of events. And one featured event is going to be a workshop at 2:30 here at the Village, during which Laverne is going to be talking about media portrayal of the trans community. So it's going to be another fascinating conversation with Laverne that you won't want to miss. So before Laverne comes out, I want to introduce our moderator for tonight. Most recently, he was seen right here on the stage in one of the most incredibly reviewed productions that the Center has ever put on, a play by the name of Beast of Times. I hope it's not wrong for me to say this, but I heard that it might be coming back for 1 week next year. So keep an eye out, because we are hopefully going to be doing more productions with D'Lo. D'Lo is a queer Sri Lankan American. He is a political theater artist, a writer, a director, a producer, a musical producer, and a comedian. So without further ado, please welcome our moderator, D'Lo.
All right, beautiful people, thank you so much. Are you all excited for today? I am so excited to be here today with you all. I want to give Laverne the proper introduction that she deserves. So let me just read this. Laverne Cox is an American actress, reality star, and transgender activist. Cox has a reoccurring role in the new Netflix series Orange is the New Black, playing Sophia Burset. She is best known as a contestant on the first season of VH1's I Want to Work for Diddy, and for producing and co-hosting the VH1 makeover television series Transform Me, which made her the first African-American transgender woman to produce and star in her own TV show. Both those shows were nominated for GLAAD Media Awards for Outstanding Reality Programs, and when Diddy won in 2009, Cox accepted the award at the GLAAD ceremony, giving a speech described by San Francisco Sentinel as among the most poignant because it reminded us how important it is to tell our stories, all of our stories. She has also acted in a number of TV shows and films, including Law & Order, SVU, Bored to Death, and Musical Chairs. Laverne was named as one of the most influential trans people in America in the inaugural Trans 100 in 2013. She was named as one of the top 50 trans icons by the Huffington Post in 2012, and she was named one of Out Magazine's Out 100 in 2010. In addition to her work as an entertainer, she speaks and writes about transgender rights and other current affairs in a variety of venues, such as the Huffington Post. Please give a warm welcome to Laverne Cox.
Having me. I'm so honored to be here.
So, we had a list of questions that were given to us and that we also talked about last week. And then just sitting in the dressing room over the past, 45 minutes, there were like 100 more questions we came up with. So I want to get through this. We have limited time. It's exactly 9. I have to leave to get on a plane. So we're going to get through this. We're going to keep it popping. I hope you all are caffeinated.
Hi.
We love you too.
We do the real casual, like that, yeah.
Where are my notes? That's funny. I have like 17 pages and I can't find my notes. Did we print a double side? They might still be in the... Ah! Phew! That's all right. Let it be. It's okay. It's good. All right. Given that there are very few trans role models, and even few trans people of color as role models, trans youth often have to choose cisgender role models or have no role models at all. Who were your role models when you were a youth? Who are your role models today? And aside from yourself, who are the role models for young trans women of color?
First of all, I want to start by thanking the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center for having me here tonight. Thank you, Jake and John, for all you've done to be here. And thanks to everyone for coming out tonight. The question of role models is funny because I've always sort of hated that word role model because it makes me feel, I've always thought that like the idea to sort of model your life after someone else seems a little presumptuous, and for me to assume that someone else should model their lives after me, I've never believed that, but I like the term possibility model. I prefer possibility model. And some of the, when I was growing up, one of my idols, and my idol to this day, is this black opera singer named Leontine Price. I don't know if you've heard of her. Some Leontine Price fans in the house. And I remember my mother gave me this, I'm from Mobile, Alabama, and my mother gave me this, a couple of different black history books, and she was in both of them. And I remember staring at this photo of her with this turban, and she's big, full lip, similar to mine. And she's this beautiful, very regal, black woman who was really the first black international opera singer. And she, for me, represented being the very best at what it is that you do as an artist. I started out very young, at 5 years old, I started dancing, and I begged my mother to put me into dance classes, and by the time I was 8, she finally relented. And so I grew up dancing, and I've always known that I wanted to be a performer and act and stuff. And I, because of people like Leontine Price and Eartha Kitt and Katherine Dunham, I knew that I had to be the very best at what I did. And these were artists, too, who were black in the 50s and 60s and who broke down barriers. And because they were so good at what they did. And so I grew up thinking that if I'm really, really good at what I do, I might be able to break down barriers for my people. I didn't really know about the trans thing at the time, but that resonated for me in a really strong way when I was a kid. So those were some of my role models when I was growing up.
And what was the next part of the question about trans role models? It was...
who are yours? Aside from yourself, who are the role models for young trans women of color that are out there right now?
Oh, gosh. Everyone chooses their own. I think everyone sort of relates to someone for whatever reason. I love this idea. There's a beautiful book called Disidentifications by Jose Munoz. Do you know? Disidentifications, Jose talks about how historically queer people have disidentified. Basically meaning that they found some identification in a figure that's not culturally coded for them to identify with. And one of my favorite example from the book is he talks about James Baldwin identifying with Betty Davis because they had these sort of similar eyes. And, you know, James Baldwin's this black gay man at the time, and Betty Davis is, you know, this is what, Hollywood, whatever, but he disidentified with her. And so I love that idea. So I think queer folks throughout time have been disidentifying. I think if we have more trans folks on television and trans folks in the media, we don't have to disidentify as much anymore. We can directly identify and see that it's culturally coded for us to identify with certain people.
Right
now?
Just because I want to get specific.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I knew I shouldn't have had this beans earlier.
Who are you so happy about out there in the world that you feel is either doing the same work that you're doing, or whether it's like in the entertainment industry or as an activist or a combination, who identify and have been
women who identify as men?
You know, the first person who comes to mind is Janet Mock. Janet is huge, and Janet has connected with people in a way that I don't think I ever could. She's so beautiful, and she's so smart, and she has such empathy, and she is such savvy. You should check out The Outlist on HBO. I think it's premiering June 29th, and Janet's part of The Outlist, the only trans woman who's part of that list. Janet has been just amazing. She gets it. She's smart, and I feel very lucky to know her, and I've seen how she touches people's lives from afar and from very close. And it's really, really exciting to have. I mean, she's a possibility model, I think, for a lot of people. She has a master's degree in journalism from NYU. She was the editor of People.com. She's gorgeous. She's a gorgeous boyfriend. She's really smart. And Janet is huge for me, and I think she's huge for a lot of folks out there.
Right. Great. Thank you for that. You said that Janet was smart and beautiful, and I'm like, no. You're like, she's different, she's smart, she's like, no, look what we got here. I was kind of even just excited in a vain way just to be sitting across from her. So here we go. What are the biggest challenges of not just constantly educating people on transgender issues, but to also be the face of transgender women of color? There is a second component to this, but I would like for you to talk about what that's like for you to bring your whole self, in particular artist, actress, and activist, into every situation. And you can also, if you wanted to talk about like what we were talking about earlier about what it's like for you.
First of all, the idea of being the face of a community is a lot of pressure. It's a tremendous amount of pressure, and sometimes it's extremely overwhelming, and it's a lot of responsibility. I take it seriously, but sometimes I have these moments of being like, well, I'm very imperfect, and I'm going to make mistakes, and I might not say the right thing every time, and I might upset someone with something I do, and it's scary. Mm-hmm. It's really, really scary. And then there's also just being in the public eye, too, I think, for anyone who is. There's a lot of people who will say certain things that are always nice about you. So you have to get a thick skin, and I try not to take myself so seriously all the time, but then I try to also remember that I do represent a certain segment of the population that doesn't have a voice often. Mm-hmm. Trans women of color, specifically black trans women, don't often have a voice. And so it's important for me, as much as possible, I have to speak for myself, but I have to try to highlight their voices and their issues too. So it's a lot. It's a lot, and it's freaky. And the piece of like negotiating like all these different sides of myself and bringing all these different sides of myself all the time, it depends on what venue I'm in. One of the biggest reasons I love being an actor is that for me, being an actor and being an artist is about being flawed. And this idea of the tragic flaw, when we deal with characters in fiction and in film and TV, and I love playing extremely flawed characters because I get to just be messy and I get to, not be perfect. And I'm not perfect in real life, but I feel like there's this thing, maybe it's in my head, but I feel like that people want to assume if you are black and if you're trans that you're not going to be articulate, that you're not going to be educated, that you're not going to show up and be professional and be on time. And I feel this pressure every single time I have a job, every single time I have an audition, every time I show up for something like this, that I have to be so, I don't want to say perfect, but I have to bring it, because the stakes are really high. People don't want to let someone like me in the door, So I have to bring it every single time, and that's a lot of pressure. And when I get a character who's messy and who's fun, and I don't have to be that, and it's really, really liberating. So
And I just and I pick my battles too. When I go into I remember when we were shooting Transform Me, the VH1 makeover show that I did 3 years ago. When we were shooting that, there were a lot of moments when I was just like, I maybe need to not say something about this because I'm going to have to really push on this.
Yeah.
You know, just casting trans women. I was involved in casting all the women, and we did auditions, and I was just like, okay, this is the questions you don't ask trans women when you interview them. You know, and so doing that stuff, it's like you can't. None of this is about what their surgical status is. That's not relevant in terms of them being able to do the job, right? And so those kinds of things, and then pushing back on other things about language, and we won't say this, and we won't say that. So it's exhausting. It's really exhausting, and it's a lot of pressure. Shooting Transform Me was just—it was a dream come true. I'd always dreamed of starring in my own show, but it was a lot of pressure. Again, because how many black trans women are starring in their own shows on VH1?
Curiosity to follow up on that question.
Yes.
In terms of either casting from auditioning to actually playing the role, what are some of what's a story in which you really had to go, okay, this is not right, and say something and sort of be called out for it? Or in the instances where you might have just been like, you know what? I think I have to let this one slide in order to get to another spot where I can say something.
Yeah. I won't say the movie. I won't say the movie. There are a few moments in a movie I did where I was thinking. And the way I like to cloak it is when I'm dealing with producers or my director. Usually it's my director. Sometimes it's occasionally the writer. TV is the writer's the king. So it's like, as a trans woman, I would never say this, and I don't know any trans women who would say it like this. Maybe we should say it differently. So that's the way I was sort of phrasing it. I remember just sort of pushing back really hard and saying with the director that we had this whole thing about this one moment in the film. And I was like, this is offensive, this is dumb. You know, so I remember writing this long email, and I was like, I would never do this, but being very, like, trying to be diplomatic about it, and then the director ended up going with the language that I didn't like, and I was like, okay, I quit the job, you know, I needed the job at the time, and it was a great role another way, so I let it go, and I did the line with, you know, trepidation. And it also reminds me, too, with this whole thing of representation, because I think, like, folks have been very critical of me and some of the choices I've made as an actress in my reality TV stint. I always think about where black folks were in the 50s and 60s in terms of representation.
Right.
And it's incremental. We can't have all of this sort of three-dimensional, fully humanized representations all at once.
Yeah.
It takes time to fully get there. And so that I have to remind myself of that as I go on the journey, and I like to say that out loud too, so that folks can remember. It doesn't mean that we don't push back.
Oh, he's just singing. I'm about to snatch the phone and pick it up.
This girl's on fire. So I have to remind myself of the fact that things are incremental in terms of representation. I like to remind folks of that as well. That doesn't mean that we don't push back. It doesn't mean that we can't be critical. And I think also folks being critical of me has pushed me to... Because the reality is that even though I'm in the public eye, whatever, I'm evolving. I'm a human being who's evolving in terms of my own activism, in terms of my artistry, and constructive criticism is welcome.
Yeah.
Loving constructive criticism.
Not when they're just slamming you in a YouTube comment, right?
Oh my God. That's a whole, I could talk
I know, about that. Well, I'm glad that you... you know, talk about what it's like, you know, because many of us in all of our different spaces, whether it be the nonprofit world or just going to Trader Joe, we have to negotiate what we're going to pick as our battle. And, you know, sometimes we might feel like we've lost the whole day, and then the next day we might have one victory. Really, y'all? Can we just shut your phones off? I'll be your best friend.
All right, so I want to jump into this question. Actually, we'll save that one, that special one.
Okay.
The LGB movement has been predominantly led by gay and lesbian, white, cisgender men and women. The T has been developing into its own movement for a shorter length of time, but has picked up momentum over the last few years. I think that it's been a little bit longer than a few years. But is it a movement that is more conscious of race and class privilege? Or is it following the footsteps of the LGB? How can the T become more conscious of race and class issues and integrate them into our dialogue and activism?
So
that's a very loaded and thick and juicy. Poke it from all different sides so the juice will land on
it. Poke it from all different sides. Really, we're going there now.
We are. Third question.
Wow. You know, I'd like to think we're more conscious of race and class in the trans community, but it depends on who you talk to. It depends on what organization, what LGBT, what trans organization you talk to. It depends on what trans person you talk to. I was at the Philadelphia Trans Health Conference last weekend, among some other amazing folks. And you know, I was approached by a white trans woman who was interested in, you know, trying to reach out to trans folks of color, you know, and I become aware that sometimes when folks reach out, is it a tokenism thing, or are we really interested in having trans people of color have economic justice, have access to health care, have all the things that we need to have? And I think there's certain folks that we talk to, and it's huge, often folks of color, and then there's a lot of aware white folks too, who are LGB and T, who are like, no, we have to. Trans folks of color are the most disproportionately oppressed of all the LGBTQ folks, right? The Anti-Violence Project in New York just released their annual report. In 2012, homicides of trans women went up from 40% in 2011 to 53.8% in 2012. While, interestingly enough, overall LGBTQ hate crimes went down 4%, our percentage went up almost 14 percentage points. So, but this isn't new, and we're dying. We're dying, we're being murdered, and there's a lot of folks who don't care, who don't give a fuck, and I cursed.
This is not network.
And it's sort of that Kanye West thing, President Bush don't care about black people.
Yeah.
And so it's a couple different things. So like a lot of folks don't care about black folks, and a lot of folks really don't care about black trans folks and trans people of color in general. So it's like, where is the love?
Right.
You know, how is the love going to be reflected in policy from our LGBT organizations, from our trans organizations? And there's some who are doing great work, and there's some who are trying to do better work. And on an individual basis, in each individual, there's these systems, there's these organizations. But I, you know, talking in front of this pejoratively, you know, like presumably queer audience, what can we do ourselves? I hate this term, but to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. What can we do in the face of the system? Because we understand that the system is oppressive, but I, perhaps naively, maybe hopefully, believe that in America, evidence to the contrary, that it is still possible, if you work really hard, that you can rise up. I you know, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that that's a myth, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to believe that. I mean, I think it's a combination that we do the work on ourselves and within the communities ourselves, and then we push for the systems to change as well. But we can't just wait for the systems to change because we're dying, and we're dying for a lot of different reasons, and that's a different conversation.
Right.
Or maybe it's not. Maybe we can talk about that now.
And we will. I wanted to talk about, we were upstairs and we were talking about some of the privileges that we have as trans people of color in relation to some of our other trans brothers and sisters. And, you know, sometimes being on the stage gives us a certain immunity. Being in film and on the stage gives us immunity. Like, I don't think Ellen will get gay bashed. You know what I'm saying? Well, I mean, she might, but what I'm saying is that, like, statistically, it would be different, right? The chances. I'm not saying that anybody should get gay bash Ellen, okay? So, what I am saying is that we talked upstairs about education, and we talked about, you know, language, and, you know, feeling the weight of the world to be articulate. And, you know, I just wanted to talk about, I wanted you to talk about, you know, the many ways that you feel like you have privilege, and the many ways that you have survived.
When I think of, it's weird, I haven't really thought of myself as privileged, interestingly mm-hmm. enough, until recently. Because mm-hmm. I've always often focused on, I'm black, I'm trans, right. and no one wants to give me a shot. And meanwhile, my life is better than a lot of trans folks of color. So, I was raised in Mobile, Alabama, single mother, very working class. We were Poe. You know, and my mother usually worked two or three jobs. I swear to God, for most of my childhood, she would have literally had three jobs to take care of me and I have a twin brother. And so I'm like, well, what's the difference? I think my mother was the difference, that my mother didn't kick me out of the house when I started, you know, doing my, you know, gender ambiguous stuff as an adolescent. There were threats of it all the time. And I think it was that she valued education. My mother was a teacher. And I was bullied majorly through all of, like, grade school, junior high. Even, I went to the Alabama School of Fine Arts in Birmingham, Alabama. Even in the art school, I got bullied. They really weren't having it. But I remember there was a time, so I wasn't doing really well in school in first and second grade, and my mother was working, like, three jobs, but she managed, there was this time when we would come from school, she would make sure that my brother and I did our homework, and she would check it, and there was this, she was working so much that there was really not a lot of quality time. But there was this moment when we weren't doing well in school that she gave us this quality time, and I could cry thinking about it now. I talked to my brother about it. I was like, I realized then, I was like, if I do well in school, my mom's going to love me more, mm-hmm. you know? And so I was like, and I equated it with, like, getting time with her and getting attention from her. And I was like, okay, she's going to love me and she's going to validate me if I make all A's, you know? So that was sort of my incentive, because I really wanted my mother to love me, and I wanted her attention and validation. And that meant the world to me. So that's a privilege. Even though my mother, you know, was very emotionally abusive, and we worked through all that, and I've been in therapy working through it, very emotionally abusive, very, you know, there was a lot of, like, what are people going to think of me, that she would say, because you were acting like, you know, why can't you act like the other boys?
Yeah.
She would say to me often, it was very abusive, and she didn't really get what all this stuff was. But we've worked through that, and there were a lot of amazing things about my mother, too. And so I think that was the difference. And I think the education piece is key. And we were saying earlier that 78% of kids K through 12 who express a transgender identity or gender non-conforming identity are harassed, 78%. So if you are harassed at school, you're probably not going to want to go,
right.
you know?
Right.
And so many of us drop out of school. And so if you're a person of color and then you don't have a high school diploma and then, of course, you can't go to college, what shot do you have, really? And what are your options?
Yeah.
And so I always say to kids, figure out a way to stay in school. Maybe it's like, I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's like, hopefully, there should be dignity for all students. Actually, we have one in New York State now. And the bullying in schools needs to stop, but we have to figure. I was bullied, like, majorly. I stayed in school. It was awful. It was awful, and it was traumatizing. I didn't even deal with the trauma of it until, like, years later.
Right.
Honestly, just being in therapy and being like, oh my God, because I had so many defenses up.
Yeah.
I think the mental health piece, too, it's been so crucial for me to be in therapy. I think, I mean, I disagree with this, but I think all trans people should be in therapy. And I think,
And I think it's because it's
I
so because it's just so hard. Transitioning is hard. What people give to you, and then the defense mechanisms that I personally built up to survive. Mm-hmm. I was so defensive. I didn't know what I was feeling because I had allowed myself to feel everything I was feeling. Growing up being bullied, my mother, you know, going home, my mother going off on me because I didn't, you know, and just not feeling safe anywhere. I felt all those feelings as a kid. I did try to kill myself at 11. I probably would have tried again.
Right.
You know, so it's like you can't feel it all then. So you have to, so the therapeutic process, being an artist, being an actor, has also helped me to feel all those feelings. And if we don't deal with the trauma of what it means to be an oppressed person, if we don't really take care of that, and take that seriously, it'll kill us. We'll end up addicted to something. Addiction is a huge, huge issue, and I love that the Gay and Lesbian Center here focuses a lot on addiction. Our Gay and Lesbian Center in New York does as well. Dealing with trauma and recovering from all that is really, really important for us.
Right, totally. I didn't want you to stop. I just pulled it off.
No, I mean, I can sort of go on.
Did you say that as a single?
No. I maybe subconsciously did. It's a lot of stuff. So,
yeah.
So education and then and therapy and recovery and healing. And
right.
Feel, you have to feel it to heal it. You know, if you're in a lot of pain and you don't allow yourself to feel it.
You can tweet that.
You have to feel it to heal it. Yeah, and then education, and there's different kinds of education. I'm not like saying everyone should go into student loan debt like I did to go to college, but it's having a critical consciousness, and college helped give me that. But developing a thinking critically, and also being willing, creating an educational base that allows you to continue to learn throughout your life. Since I graduated from college, I've learned so much, and I've been open to it though, and I'm constantly opening myself up to learn more and to challenge myself.
Totally.
And that's kind of what it's all about, I think.
Okay, you just sparked two other questions then. When do you feel like your critical consciousness began? I know you said college, but like, what were the moments where you were like?
I think, you know, I said college, and as I think about it, I think that like, growing up in Alabama with a mother who grew up in the segregated South, my mother was made me very aware of racial politics, right? Particularly growing up in Alabama, that's where it all went down in Alabama for the most part. The other thing, Mississippi.
You can tweet that too. It all went down in Alabama.
In terms of all the racial stuff. So I grew up with this awareness politically because of my mother, but it really started in college, and it started. I went to college in New York. I started at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. Then I transferred to Marymount in New York because I always wanted to live in New York. And it really was, it was at Marymount. Marymount didn't have this like crazy critical studies program, but I had friends at Columbia, and my brother was at the San Francisco Art Institute. And so I started reading bell hooks, and I started reading Michelle Wallace, and all this these racial feminist theory and racial post-colonial theory. It just started to like, I was like, oh my God, it just made sense to me. I was like, okay. And I started thinking about the world in these different terms, in these different ways. And it's a really exciting time for me, and it completely influences the way I write now,
mm-hmm.
the way I have conversations like this.
And was it scholarly writings or poetry and art that from these authors or these?
All of it. And I love Langston Hughes. So there was poetry, a lot of critical essays. Critical.
Yeah.
Critical.
I couldn't
work
read the critical essays.
Yeah.
It's too tough.
Sometimes, I mean, when I was reading Derrida of Grammatology, I was like, okay, this is a little intense.
Does anyone know Derrida?
Okay.
3 days.
Right?
To
That's
three
crazy.
Pages. That's what it was like for me. 3 days to read through 3 pages.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Speaking of living in New York, I guess this is a catch to it because I remember last year in New York there were more accounts of hate crimes against queer people that I had ever heard in all my on
last
and off
year.
Living of, in New York City. And when I brought it through to some of the people who worked at the theater that I was working in, who are also queer but white, they were like, oh no, that doesn't... Are you sure that happened? And
and I was like, it happens, and it was primarily people of color. So my question is, what now is the level of fear that you walk around with on the daily in New York? And I mean, still in this, I would love for you to frame it like in the ways that, like, we were talking about privilege and, you know, all of those things. But, you know, that's a daily thing for a lot of us. And
just walking out of the house, and what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's deep. And in New York, it's more. I was talking to a friend of mine at the conference last weekend. And she lives in Chicago. She's like, oh, that's a New York thing. Because it's the street harassment in New York. I've been telling this story a lot lately. About a decade ago, it was the 4th of July, and I decided to wear a red, white, and blue mini dress because I was feeling very patriotic. it was such a bad idea. And I lived on the Upper West Side at the time, so I was walking to the 72nd Street subway, and I passed these two guys, and I was waiting for the light to change, and one guy appeared to be Latino, and the other guy appeared to be African-American, and the Latino guy says, hey, mama, you looking sexy today, come talk to me. And the other guy's like, dude, that's a nigga. and in this context, I took nigga to mean that's a man, because in this context. And then, that honestly, I've been talking a lot of this, but honestly, that's how it lived. And a few weeks ago, something similar happened where one guy was, you know, trying to sort of step to me and say, you know, hey, mom, are you looking sexy? And another guy's like, no, you shouldn't talk to her because that's a man, basically. That's a nigga.
This is not network
television. No. So for me, it's interesting because what's interesting about the 4th of July incident is that they started arguing. So the Latino guy's like, no, that's a bitch, dude, that's a bitch. And the black guy's like, no, that's a nigga. And the Latino guy turns to me and he's like, you ain't a nigga, is you? And I was like, let me just get out of here. I tell that story because it's interesting, the intersection of trans misogyny and racism in that moment. but that's my life. You know, it's not as bad as it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, it was every day and every other block. I don't know if I'm passing more now, or I don't know what's the city's challenges. I think maybe I'm passing a little bit more now, but it just happened 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So I feel a lot safer.
Yeah.
I do feel a lot safer walking out, and a lot of it. I've also realized too. I've let go of the tape of. Are they spooking me? You say spook in New York for claw.
Yeah.
That's right.
So are they spooking me? Are they spooking me? So I'll have that internal dialogue going. So a lot of times it may not be even about that.
Right.
You know. And so I've had to just let that go.
But it has to be on because sometimes it is.
Sometimes they are. And, like, you know, I've chosen to live my life assuming that people know. And it gets exhausting. I know this is something else you wanted to talk about. But it sort of gets exhausting always being trans, always, like, constantly. I would love to have these moments. I was at a cocktail party a few weeks ago. And I was like, oh, I'm going to this cocktail party. I'm friend of mine with TJ. I was like, it's an ABC carpet or whatever. I was like, maybe I don't have to be trans today. I don't know these people. Like, girl. And so I start talking to this guy, and he's in not-for-profit fundraising. I was like, oh, really? We should talk. And the night before, I just hosted the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund benefit, so I told him that. I said, oh, I just hosted this benefit that's not-for-profit last night, the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund. He was like, transgender, is that what you are? And I said, and I had a moment, I was like, yes, I am. You know, I'm proud to be who I am. And I'm just like, yeah, I hosted this benefit and I'm trans. And he said, people were wondering. We were just talking about it.
It was a caucus.
We were talking. Is that a man or is that a woman? So in my head, I'm walking into this new space and maybe I get to not be trans, you know, at this event and just be a girl. And meanwhile, people are in the corner. Is that a man or is that a woman? So,
that's my life. And I have to accept that, or it'll drive me crazy. And I have to own, and I've talked about this before, but I have to own this trans thing. I have to own it, or it will just drive me crazy. And I know trans women, and I'm not against living stealth. I get it. Like, I have fantasies. I have my stealth fantasies. Yeah. But I know some trans women who live stealth who are just like, and it's like a little cray cray. What's going on? No, just the media, not being stealth. I'm not saying being stealth is crazy, but just what the stories that they tell themselves, are they spooking me? Do they know? What's going on? Are they going to find out? It's just this constant, like, who knows, who doesn't know, and that can make you a little cuckoo. So owning it, and just for me, this is just for me, and I'm not, this is, again, you do you, and I'm going to do me. But for me, it's I have to own this thing and accept it and be like, this is who I am.
Yeah.
Or it would drive me crazy.
Yeah. And that in and of itself is like, I feel like I have to work on that all the time, like trans all day, every day. Also, just constantly being aware, like how people are perceiving me and trying to rise above that is like every single day, as I'm sure many of us in this room feel every day, is like, you know, so that we don't go crazy with it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this, I do online dating, and immediately when I'm out, it's trans, I'm an online dating profile, the second people see that you're trans, if you're a trans woman, you're often sexualized. The second, there's this one story, then I'll let you ask the next question. There's this story years ago, I met this gorgeous Israeli man, like, on the street, and he starts talking to me, he asks me out, and then I give him my number, and then he calls me, and he says, what kind of food do you like? Oh, I would love to take you to this restaurant. And he was so, like, gentlemanly, and just, like, really, really sweet. And I was like, you know I'm trans, right? I say to him, he's like, and he had just moved from Israel, so he didn't get it. So I explained what trans means, and he said, so we don't go to dinner, I just come to your apartment. So immediately, so it went from this whole, like, let me, you know, court you, to let me come to your apartment, and we just, you know, we're just going to do it. So I understand when that's the... Not wanting to be treated like that, I see a lot of trans women would want to, like, be stealth, to not be treated like that by men, because it's awful.
Yeah.
But that's my life.
No, I feel you.
It's a nice story from my life.
Are you single?
I'm single. Yes.
I know you all wanted to know, so I did it for you.
I am single, and I only date men. To this point, only cisgender men, but I'm open.
Okay, let's get on to. I have. It's all over.
How about old men?
We can add to those questions later. We can add to those questions.
Much, on the
much
only.
Later.
I'm open.
Find the next question. In regards to your artistry and transgender stories, how do you feel your approach to doing reality TV was different than how people have been portrayed, and what was your mission in going into Transform Me?
Well, I think it really all started with our That's a good question. Just keeping it really, really real. I could say this at the time. Because, you know, when we were promoting the show, yes, I want to work for Diddy. But I never did.
I mean, who does, right?
But what had happened is this show happened in 2008, and it happened, I don't have to tell a story. Yeah, in 2007, huge inspiration to me, a huge possibility model for me was Candace Kane, who was on Dirty Sexy Money. And when that moment happened in 2007, I thought, and then Candace had sort of come up in the New York scene similarly because she was a big star than I was. And I was like, okay, this is possible now.
this is the moment. And I made these cards, and I did a mailing to find an agent. I've been auditioning for agents. I've been asking for, I was a dance major in college, and I started acting in college. And this was like, I was in the food and drugs in this place, and I had started transitioning into like the end of college. So trying for years to get an agent, and I thought, this could be the moment. So I made these postcards.
How many do you think you sent out?
About 500 to agents, commercial agents and legit agents in New York City only, and got 4 meetings out of 500.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, and then I had a commercial agent for a while, and then I have the agent that I have now to this day. And the next year, and at the time, so I did this mailing, and I was like, I'm going to start building relationships, because I learned that in this industry, if you don't have an agent, you have to build relationships with casting directors. So I started just submitting myself to things that I would find in backstage, and this is 5 years ago, so backstage is different, and just in online submissions and whatever. And I was like, the reality thing, I don't know if I want to do that, but I submitted myself for Big Brother. I wasn't able, and then the casting director really liked me, emailed me the audition or the interview was at a certain point. I couldn't do it because I had a conflict. He kept me on file, and when the Work for Diddy opportunity came along, he called me, and I only went in because I wanted to build a relationship with the casting director. And so I didn't go in thinking I wanted the gig, and they really liked me. And then I had a follow-up interview, and they really liked me, and then there was a third interview, like, we think we want you to, you know, be a semi-finalist. And I was like, do I want to do this? Do I really want to do this? And my brother told me not to do it. My producing partner at the time, Eric Nicolette, was like, you're not going to have me. And at the time, I was starting to produce, you know, some documentary stuff of my own. He said, you're not going to have any control over how your story's told. They're going to exploit you. You shouldn't do it. And I remember I was in the meetings with folks from VH1 and the folks from Left Right Entertainment who produced the show. And I was like, I don't want to be a joke on the show. I don't want to be exploited. If that's what you want to do, I'm not your girl.
Right.
And I was so adamant, and I was so adamant in the meetings. And then Rashawn Rankin, he looked me in the eye and said, as a black man, no, he was the executive producer of the show. And he said to me, he's also a top model and a bunch of other reality stuff. He's kind of huge in that world. He looked me in the eye and said, as a black man, he said to me, I promise you, that's not what we want to do with this show. Diddy doesn't want to do this with the show, with you. We think you're spectacular, and Diddy thinks you're spectacular. Apparently he saw my tape and was like, her. There was no hesitation. So, and the day before my last callback is the only time that I had got all the street harassment I had experienced. The only time it got physical was the day before my final call for I'm a Work for Diddy. It was a group of black men who were saying, I had to pass them to get to the store, and they said this homophobic, you know, transphobic, you know, stuff, and then one of them kicked me. And one of them kicked me. It was the day before the final interview for Work for Diddy, and I was thinking, God, this hip-hop black guy, like, you know, having me on his show, maybe that can make some sort of difference for me, trans folks in the black community. And that's why I did the show. That's really why I did the show. And I, you know, it was a lot of pressure. Again, it was a lot of pressure at that point. There had never been a trans person, black or otherwise, on a competition reality show. It was intense. And Diddy has this no sleep policy, so I was sleep deprived, and it was very stressful. And it was a huge risk. Still, probably one of the craziest things I've ever done in my entire life. And it led to me getting a meeting with VH1 to talk about doing my own show. We pitched the idea for Transform Me, and then that happened. So, yeah. And it started with Candace Kane being on Dirty Sexy Money, me seeing that that was possible. And I was like, well, what can I do? And so negotiating that, I think it's just, I tried to be with both shows really true to who I was. And really true to, I had a lot more fun on Transform Me. I tried to, then we, so I have this very campy, silly side. So a lot of that came out of Transform Me. Some people weren't happy with that. But it is what it is. And it was a learning experience. It was my first time starring in my own show, like in producing my own show. So there was just a learning curve. I learned a lot about, with branding, it's really about being authentic and being really truly yourself. And as an actor, it's interesting because as an actor, we're very yes-and. The director's like, do this, and you do it.
So like there was a little bit of me straddling being an actress and having my director say, do this, and I'm like, okay, I'm an actress now. And wearing both hats is very tricky.
Yeah.
But the idea is just to try to stay as true to who you are as possible. And with reality TV, if you don't give it to them, they don't have it. They can't exploit you if you don't give them material to exploit
right.
you. So it's really stressful, especially when the cameras are on you 24/7, to like sort of be on your best behavior at all times. And there's actually a moment when the cameras rolled where I went off on this contestant who had just been kind of really. And my mic wasn't on, so it didn't make it into the show. And I was like, oh my God, what have I done to the trans community? You know, after I had this fight, but it just gives so much pressure.
Yeah.
You can't even imagine when you're on these shows 24/7. There's competition, there's challenges, the cameras are always there. It's stressful. But trying to just be as authentic as possible and as true to who you are as possible. I think sometimes that's the always evolving.
And that was in the Diddy one that you went off on that person. And so I'm just thinking that your first reaction was, what did I do to the trans community? Which is so deep. And then now with Transform Me, what are these moments, what is like the moments of freedom and the moments of reprieve that you have in doing your own and being
a creator? It's weird, because like, the thing about Transform Me, I'm being so real, it's going to be, see how this bites me in the tissue later. But I did, you know, the whole makeover thing I thought was an idea that the network would buy.
Right.
I thought them, because it ultimately would be about the three transgender women making over, it would be about the cisgender women that were making over.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understood that because representation is incremental, right? That like to having a show that's really about the trans women, maybe they wouldn't do it. And then like there was some interest in me because of, apparently I was popular on Island Work for Diddy. That was, according to French Elle, I was the crowd favorite. So, you know, I thought that was an idea that they would buy, but I never wanted my brand necessarily to be synonymous with making people over.
Right.
I was very ambivalent. Like, I even though I watch makeover shows and I like makeover shows, I hate the idea of dictating to women what they should and shouldn't wear
right.
and
right.
that you should have to do this. And I tried to do the show and approach the show in a way that wouldn't do that. That wouldn't be this like dictatorship about you have to do this and this and this more, and trying to sort of like, you know, police gender and police femininity. I think that's bullshit.
Right.
So I didn't want to do that kind of makeover show. So I think like in a way, in retrospect, I was sort of fighting the genre.
Mm-hmm.
I was working in a genre that I was like that's what the genre really does.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, we can't do that. We can't say that. So there was a lot of these moments. You have no idea. It's like, no, we can't say that.
Yeah.
No, you can. No.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Right.
So that's the interesting, but we sold it. It sold, you know, and the
mm-hmm.
network was like, yay, let's do it. So, yeah.
Great. And just last, because I'm also curious.
Yeah.
When you, so this, the new Netflix, the Orange is the New Black.
July 11th, if we premiere on Netflix, please watch.
So if this is like a marker in your career, what do you feel like it will do? Well, talk to us about the project in case people don't know, and then tell us about what your personal investment is in.
So first of all, this dress is really short. I'm trying not to give you a Lindsay Lohan.
I know. I was just waiting for somebody to be like, it's okay.
So Orange is the New Black is a new Netflix original series from Jinji Cohen, who created Weeds. And the series is set, it's a 13-episode series, at least the first season, the second season, fingers crossed. And it follows Piper Chapman, who is an upper-middle-class Caucasian engaged Brooklynite who ends up in a federal women's prison because of a decade-old drug charge. And when she goes to prison, she has to acclimate herself to prison culture, and she meets a really interesting and diverse group of women, including my character, Sophia Brissett, who is, among other things, is the hairstylist in prison. Yes, convicts get their hair done in prison, which is kind of cool. Female convicts, anyway. The job was amazing for me.
The scripts are really smart and really crisp and drop-dead funny. Mm-hmm. And whenever I would get a new script in my email, I'd be like, it's like opening a Christmas present. And the scripts were so funny, so I'd be sitting at home alone laughing out loud. And I would just start crying. And a moment would happen that would be so tragic and so moving, and I would just start crying. And it was really, it's the kind of job I've been waiting for my whole career, really. And most folks know me because of the reality show thing. And I never really set out or wanted to do reality TV. I saw it as an opportunity to provide visibility for my people and a way to advance my career. And it worked out pretty well for me. I'm really grateful for reality TV, but I've been acting since I was a kid, and I've been studying and very serious about it. So I'm just excited that I've had this opportunity. Jodie Foster, you should know, directs episode 3. Getting to work with her was a dream come true. I've idolized her for, like, my entire life. And episode 3 is also the episode where we find out all about Sophia, my character, why she's in jail, what her life is like outside of prison, etc. So it was just major for me to be able to have this opportunity to work with amazing directors. Andrew McCarthy directs a handful of episodes. Jodie Foster, Michael Trims are executive producers, direct a lot of the episodes. Amazing actors. It was an incredible opportunity for me. And it's still, I think about, there's not a lot of, think of a black trans woman with a recurring role on a TV show, and I can't. I can't right now. Maybe someone can help me out afterwards.
What?
I said we can't.
We can't.
I didn't think so. I try to stay pretty abreast of like of what's going on in media. So I mean that's major. So it's like okay, this is possible. And you know I think about you know Candace was the first. This isn't a primetime show, but you know. 6 years ago, you know, I had that possibility model with Candace, and now I'm like, I have a recurring role on a series myself. So that's just major for me personally, and it's possible. It's possible. Yeah. You know, it's possible too because Jinji Cohen, it's based on a memoir, and so written by Piper Kerman, the same title. And there was a trans woman in her real experience in prison. Trans women are in prisons, as we know. Oftentimes, they're in men's prisons. With the new provisions of the Prison Rape Elimination Act, now trans women should be housed according to their gender choice. Though that's not fully implemented around the country yet. But just having a trans woman in a women's prison and having you know the country see that is major and really important. And so that's huge. So we'll see. You know, I'm
so happy. I am so happy because I always feel like I'm looking out there, even for queer people who aren't being, you know, like I've done theater as a for not being able to get an agent who would take a chance on me. And I showed, and we talked about this, we've tried to show in front of agents and they don't know what to do with it. And then when in the theater, I only see gay people doing the background dancing in musicals or they're in the musicals, and it's not really a multidimensional character that we're seeing. And so I'm always excited whenever I see, even in reality or in, you know, not reality television, where you see characters that are written well. And as you know, more often than not, we don't get to see these multidimensional storylines.
Well, I just read Jinji, our creator, and she wrote the first and last episode. Jinji, in this interview, really talked about how really real, and I appreciated it because we've been pitching shows, me and my producing partner, for about 7 years about trans women. We got to pilot phase at a couple different networks. They're not buying it. They're scared. Their networks are really afraid of having trans women on TV. And what Jinji said very honestly and very astutely is that having an upper middle class, blonde, white woman in prison, you can sell that to a network, right? And then it gives you an opportunity to tell the stories of all the women of color who are in the prison and what why they're there, what their lives are like. And the show really does that. These stories are so powerful and so moving, and the characters are so multidimensional. Really, and thinking of, I never really thought about this, but prisons are this microcosm of different women from, we have different ages, body types, Asian, Latin, Latina, black, you know, just the spectrum of women in the show. And I've just never seen anything like this on TV with this kind of diversity. I'm just excited to have been a part of it. Can't wait for all you to see it.
Can't wait. Because I'm keeping to schedule, we have some questions from the audience.
Cool.
Some, I don't know if I can get to all of them, but...
Can you have a count, Tori?
I would like one,
too.
Would
you like an out, Tori, darling?
Thank you. delicious. So
this is all I can eat because of the premiere. This is all I should be eating until Tuesday. You should have a diet of Altoids.
And water. And some flower petals. Okay. First one, because it's thick. Do you like being classified as the first African-American transgender woman to appear on a reality TV show? If you were Caucasian, they would not mention the race, but only the transgender part. Yeah. They wrote, yeah.
Do I like it?
Or how about, let's not make it as simple as that. Why is it important for you to say that, and why is it important for it to be out there as such?
As far as I know, it's true. And, I mean, the race piece is important. The fact that I'm black is important, that I don't stop. I love, if you don't know Courtney Ryan's, Dr. Courtney Ryan Ziegler's documentary about black trans men called Still Black, you should go check it out. It's a really great documentary that my blackness doesn't go away simply mm-hmm. because I'm trans, right? So.
My blackness doesn't go away just because I'm Sri Lankan. The cops still think I'm black.
And race is a social construct. And so it's really important that black folks see that this is possible and that our identities are not erased. I think historically, we talked a little bit about this, and I'm going to be talking more extensively about this tomorrow at my workshop about trans representations in media and film. But like historically, over the past 60 years, when we look at transgender representations in mainstream media, it's mostly been white trans folks. And so there's all these moving and amazing stories and identities that we don't know about. We don't know about. There's partly that's because of the stealth thing, and partly because of the erasure
of black trans identity and just trans identity of color in general. So it's really important to say to emphasize that. I think because it is a social construct and the political ramifications of what it means to be black. I think you know. It's so about perception, because if someone perceiving you as black, it's like, okay, then you're going to be dealing with the stuff that like black folks deal with, because people see you that way. And their political realities, their realities of dealing with the police, of walking down the street and being racially profiled, of people, you know, the cops assuming that if you have condoms, you're a sex worker. All that stuff happens, and there's a part of the political reality that maybe you won't be able to get a job because you're black. And they don't want to hire somebody else. We just saw Paula Deen's lovely, lovely moment.
Oh, yeah.
This is still going on.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't, I'm from the South, so it's like, it's real. So those intersectionalities are really the double binds of being, you know, of having multiple oppressed identities is really real. And being a woman and being sexualized.
Yeah.
Because I'm a woman, and it's like there's a part of me that's like, oh, they think I'm hot. They think I'm hot. And there's this little validation piece there, and I think that just being aware of that for me is like, okay, I'm kind of enjoying this that this person is validating me, but I am aware that there's something exploitative about this at the same time.
Yes, totally.
Like having really being able to like say that to myself about some just passing, you know, hot guy on the street, or some, you know, getting a message on a dating site that's like inappropriate.
Yeah.
Which most of them are. so it's a race matters.
Race matters, and also the flip side of it is that in you know you're talking about like what I call when the exotification of trans people
And then, because the narrative has been predominantly white, then we are also dealing with the fact that inclusivity sometimes means accidental tokenism of our bodies. And I, did that make sense? Did I sound too academic? If I did.
Yeah.
but I feel like, you know, sometimes I'll get called to do something that is trans and I'll be the only person of color in the room.
Me too.
And so that's another reason why I always, and plus part of my heritage is that I'm Tamil, and I say I'm Tamil Sri Lankan because of the war and historically and everything, and then putting it all, and to this day my bio says it all. I say it all on purpose, not just D'Lo is an actor. It will never say that because I feel like it's so important to historically document who's out there, you know?
Yeah.
You should applaud for that.
So, what in your... Okay, I want to get back to this one. But let's just get to this very important one. What is your favorite color nail polish?
I don't often wear color. Like, I have like a French manicure thing going on. So I'm clear a lot, but I, like, this is color at this salon called Scarlett O'Hara. That I really like. Do we know Scarlett O'Hara?
Gone with the Wind?
Gone with the Wind, fabulous, yes.
Gone with
the Wind. It's called Scarlett O'Hara. It's like a deep red.
If somebody was bold, what kind of problems did you run into or do you run into during your transition?
Street harassment is the first thing that comes to mind. This just feeling really unsafe in public space is huge, 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 huge. I don't talk about this a lot publicly because I don't talk about the details. And we'll talk more about this in the workshop tomorrow. But I don't talk about the details of the medical details of my transition publicly because so often folks want to make it all about surgery. All about that, and that becomes the only takeaway when we tell transgender stories in the media. So I don't talk about that, but I had some discrimination in healthcare that was really deep to me. About a decade ago, where I had gone to a hospital for a surgical procedure, and it was really inexpensive because it was a learning hospital, and a trans girl I knew had gone for the same procedure like a couple months earlier. I was like, oh, it was only a couple $1,000. I was like, oh my god, that's great. So going for the consultation, and like, oh, we can't operate on you because you're trans. I'm like, why? We ended up suing the hospital, and they changed their policy. But the reason I don't talk about it is because I know people, when I walk into space as an openly trans person, people are already looking at like, okay, where can I how big are her hands? And side note, when I told my mother that I was transitioning, the first thing she said to me is, but you're so tall and you have such big hands and feet. That's like, I think it's funny now. I understand that people are like dissecting me when I walk into space. So talking about surgery or not and the details of that don't really help people not to dissect me. So that's why I don't.
Right on, gotcha. So, this one we had read together, I think. What do you think the next phase and key issues are for trans activism in the near future?
Oh, gosh. It's the next phase. Oh God! What I'd like to see happen. I mean, we're in New York State. We still haven't gotten the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act passed. As of now, it hasn't been brought before the Senate to be passed. I think having a part of it is having policies like the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act and like ENDA on a federal level. That having policies that begin to destigmatize what it means to be trans. Because I think. Really, I've been thinking a lot about this lately. I think the biggest issue for trans folks is that folks don't acknowledge a
us as who we are, as who we know we are. So folks won't acknowledge that I'm a woman, you know. Folks won't acknowledge that your you know, masculinity and your manhood is it, because that's who you fundamentally are. So we don't acknowledge that. So in our identities are stigmatized. So we need policies in place and media representations that don't stigmatize
right.
our identities anymore.
Right.
I think that's the future. I think that's the future, and it goes into so many. I mean, there's immigration issues, right? With detainees and asylum, and so often, you know, trans women are not. When our womanhood isn't acknowledged, then that puts us in certain kinds of danger, right? So realizing that trans women's issues are women's issues is a really important piece of it, and that goes into so many different policies, prison policies. Bathrooms, when we're talking about kids, you know, trans kids using the bathroom in Colorado and Maine and all over the country.
Military.
Don't ask, don't tell. Still exists for trans folks. Trans folks can't serve openly in the military. I just told this. I met last year at the in Washington, D.C., I met this guy who has gone to Iraq a couple of times. And I was like, oh, you're in the military. He's like, yeah. But, like, I have to say, and this is a guy. I mean, this guy is like, he has to say he's a woman. They won't acknowledge his male identity. I gagged. I was in the whole. I knew that trans folks weren't included in the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but it didn't hit me until I met him and he said, "Yeah, I've gone to Iraq a couple times, and I have to. They won't acknowledge my name's been changed, but it hasn't been changed in the military records. And people see me and they see a man, but then my commanding officer, oh, now that's a woman."
Yeah.
Hmm.
It's crazy. It's insane. So this guy wants to serve his country. He's going serving, and we won't acknowledge who he is, and who everyone sees him as being.
So, I mean, a lot of it is just acknowledging our core identity, having the world say, you are who you say, okay, yes, and let's have policies that reflect that. Let's have representation in the media that reflects us so people can get to know us, and let's tell our stories in a way that...
this question kind of brings up another sort of something for me because, I mean, I might get flack for this, but you know, I'm not like pro-military or even for, because I'm worried that for people are just going to suffer, and I have friends who work. For SWAN, the Service Women Action Network in New York, and they're who you see in the news, and these stories are just like devastating. And then you talk about you know, what it is with the U.S. involvement in everything. So, whatever. But what I'm trying to say is that intersectionality and in regards to trans activism, this question, I feel like, you know, policies and media representation too, but can you also talk about how the conversation needs to change now in regards to what we've also been talking about?
The intersectionality piece is huge. When I say that trans women's issues are women's issues, that's looking intersectionally, and that's acknowledging. There was my brother, Melissa, we love Melissa Harris Perry. She's done.
Is this your twin brother?
My twin brother, yeah. We were having a conversation about a recent moment on the Melissa Harris Perry show where... Elaine Sturtz from Get Equal, you know, she heckled the First Lady, and in the conversation, Melissa Harris Perry was sort of saying that you know, what I think is dangerous now for the LGBT folks is that, you know, black folks have been really good. Lately, black folks have been really good. Obama's come out in favor of marriage equality, and black folks have sort of been getting on board with the LGBT thing. If you heckle our First Lady, we're not gonna stay on board. And my brother pointed out to me, it's like, that's suggesting that these LGBT people are not black too.
Yeah.
So even and Melissa has been very astute and very progressive in having a lot of trans folks on her show and talking about these issues, but that moment totally erased black LGBT people.
Totally erased. So it's like, how do we really begin to have discussions, intersectional discussions, when we talk about economic injustice, talking about trans people, talking about LGBT people, and having that be a part of the discussion?
Violence Against Women. I mean, it was like to the nail to have a Violence Against Women Act that was LGBT inclusive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so having policies that include us, you know, in terms of race and gender and class. And the class piece is like, in America right now, that really is the piece.
Yeah.
That really is like, because if like you are black and you are a millionaire, if you're black and Beyonce or Jay-Z, it's over for you.
You get to go to Cuba.
You get to go to Cuba. Exactly. It's, you know, the financial piece. It's this, it's like if you're poor in this country, it kind of doesn't matter what race you are.
Yeah.
You are.
Yeah.
I was about to say, the N-word, but we've used that enough today.
I'm glad that you talked about that, and I'm sure that we'll have more discussions around this. I have a couple more questions, and I'm trying to stay within our time block because we have 8 more minutes.
Oh, my.
But you can applaud because we've done so well so far. Oh. I know. I just wanted to big myself up for a little bit. Okay. We'll save that one for the last one. This question, I really liked it, and so I want to ask it, but you've already touched heavily on it. What, in your opinion, is the future like as far as opportunity in the entertainment industry, both in the USA and in the world, and for transgender women? Any advice, feedback would be highly appreciated. And I know that our queer community, we are so creative, like it is, that is us. We are the most creative motherfuckers on this planet. Unfortunately, because the opportunities haven't been there, we've had to negate that side of us. And when we kill our creativity, we're creating our spiritual life. Right? So I want to hear what you have to say about creativity, opportunities for queer people. And not in that, you know, like the, just do it, you know, go ahead, try it, you know. But speaking from the heart, and given what you have come from, what can we hear from you that can be our line of hope?
That was really beautiful when it's about killing our creativity. We kill part of ourselves. And so my acting coach, Brad Calcaterra, back in New York City, started this class called Act Out, and it's specifically a class for LGBT actors to work on our stuff. There was one guy in the class who was 70 years old. He had studied with Strasberg and Meisner, I don't know if you knew, the major like acting folks from back in the day, acting teachers and schools of acting, and had never done a same-sex scene, and he's a gay man. And he studied with these major people, 70 years old. And so this class is not just about doing, you know, same-sex scenes, but there's a couple trans women in the class as well. It's really about us, and one of the points that Brad makes is that so often we'll see LGBT people as the person, you know, doing the hair, doing the makeup, coaching, you know, taking care of the talent, when we are still creative ourselves. And so often we are told, particularly for actors, Brad was finding that like his gay male actors couldn't play gay. There's these stereotypes out there of you know, can you make it a little gayer, that are very problematic. But as an actor, you have to book the job and you have to do it.
Yeah.
And there sometimes can be humanity in a stereotype too. And I know as stereotypes are often based on real folks. The reality is that some people embody a stereotype, but they're human beings underneath that.
Yeah.
And hopefully the writing and the end or the actor will bring out that humanity.
Yeah.
So I think the future is us, you know, challenging ourselves as artists. For me, it's been about challenging myself to be more than that. Years ago, I had a brilliant acting coach, and she's really my acting mentor, named Susan Batson. She, I don't know who her, she's amazing. I stayed with her for about 5 years. She coached Nicole Kidman and Julia Binoche. She worked with Fox on Ray. And she's an amazing black woman. And she said, you know, they will, you're an exotic, she talks like this. And, you know, it was very sort of, you know, over the top acting teacher. She's in Girl 6, that Spike Lee movie, as the acting coach, if you've ever seen that. And she was like, they'll have you in these sort of exotic roles unless you, as an artist, say, no, 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 I'm more than that. I can make you cry. I can make you
feel something and really move you, and that is your job as an actor and an artist. And I took that challenge, I took that charge, and it's been hard, you know, it's been very, very difficult, but I haven't given up yet. I haven't given up yet, and I don't plan to. So I think a lot of it is about challenging ourselves to go deeper and to find those ways. There are people out there in the industry who are their own types. I look at someone like a Whoopi Goldberg, or I look at a Gabrielle Sidibe. And Whoopi Goldberg has an Oscar, and Whoopi Goldberg, you know, we're going to know who knows who she is, and she's had a major career, and she doesn't look like anyone else in the industry. No one else is like her, but she cultivated this undeniable thing about her craft that no one could watch The Color Purple. I don't think anyone could, even though she didn't get the Oscar. But I don't think anyone can watch her in that film and say that this is not a moving performance.
Right.
This person is not exceptional.
Right.
I think so, very similarly for Gabrielle Sidibe, there are other folks in the entertainment industry, but we have to challenge ourselves with the creativity and with really... doing what my role model, Leontine Price, if you know, some people may not be opera fans, but she was exceptional. She's amazing.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of the challenge. And not settling and believing that we deserve to be, you know, in major motion pictures as the lead.
Right.
And fighting for that.
Yeah. At time, just to quickly, just because you are talking about like what it is once you're in the once you're in the room, and I'm sure that there are a lot of young artists out there in the audience, maybe older artists, it just depends. But what would, if you could give like, I don't know, a couple of pointers as to like in your specific field, what would you give as advice to get to the place in which you're at?
I think you have to train. I think if you are serious about being an actor, you have to train. You find a really good coach. I love the coach I'm working with now. She's a working actor, too, to deal with what it means to be in an audition room. Mm-hmm. And learn the business. Learn to build relationships with casting directors and always be professional. And keep building relationships and keep studying and keep digging deeper and going on auditions, submitting yourself, learn as much about the industry as possible.
What would you say is professional to you? What is professionalism in your case?
I think it's always...
I'm just trying to squeeze them in, guys.
Being on time, ideally being early for auditions, extremely important. Being really prepared. So not only knowing your lines, having, you know, knowing your beats, knowing your subtext, and really being prepared when you walk into the room. And then also being able to listen. Being able to, again, because we have all our defenses and we have, and not take stuff personally. So that, like, sometimes for me, historically, I would be in the room and I would get an adjustment. An adjustment is when they say, oh, you've done the scene this way, let's try it this way. And I would take the adjustment as a judgment.
Mm.
So then I would take it all very personally, and then I would get defensive in my head. And it's not really professional. I mean, it's my psychological and emotional stuff that I need to work through, and that's part of the training process. But being professional is doing it.
Yeah.
Being professional is saying, okay, I'll try it this way now.
Right. Beautiful. Yeah.